We're all in boxes. Everything we bring to the table brings with it constraints. And it's important to know that, to understand that our perspective is very, very narrow.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Peter DeJager. You might remember he was on some time ago. Well, he's back. Here's three facts about Peter that I think you should know. One, his very first formal presentation more than 40 years ago was on problem solving. Two, he is a character in a science fiction novel by Robert Sawyer called Rollback. Three, he was born in South Africa, raised in Ireland, and he lives in Canada. Oh, and here's a bonus point. He is fascinated by the Japanese strategy game of Go, which I believe goes back thousands of years.
Thousands of years. We're not quite sure of the origins. We think it started in China.
Ah, Peter DeJager, welcome to Your Intended Message.
George, thanks for having me back. Always great to be here.
Peter, last time we talked about change. This time, let's explore problem solving, because I'm sure the two of them are related. And problem solving seems like a necessary skill that I'm guessing a lot of people misunderstand and don't take full advantage of problem solving. Is that a fair stab at it?
It is the core foundational skill that we operate with. Every single day, every second that we're making a decision, we're actually solving a problem. We have a current state. And in problem solving, that would be called state zero, the initial state. And we want to achieve something else, state next, state number one, the goal that we're trying to move to. So everything is about problem solving. And for most people, they think of problem solving in the context of mathematics. You're given a problem to solve and you have to do it. And we don't think of ourselves as problem solvers in our day-to-day life. Now, that said, we're pretty good at it. We could be a lot better if we just followed some basic concepts. I won't say rules, because problem solving isn't about rules. It's about being able to be nimble and dance with a problem until you get to an answer.
Now, nimble and dancing doesn't sound anything like mathematic at all. And that might be why people misunderstand problem solving. I think one of the dangers of math, of people associating problem solving with math, Peter, is that there's only one right answer.
In mathematics, there is one right answer. There are many, many different ways to get to the right answer, but there will only be one single right answer. If I ask you if a number is prime, the answer is either going to be yes or no. And if it's yes, it's yes. And it's always going to be yes. Doesn't matter who does it, where they do it, when they did it, or if they'll do it in the future. But in people problem solving, it's totally different. One of the key books that I referred to back a lot is Are Your Lights On by Gerald Weinberg and Gauss. Donald Gauss, just checked it because it's on my desk all the time. In that book, they have a problem that sums up what problem solving is really all about. There's a company, large building, brand new. And they've misunderstood the type of clients they're going to be getting. So they miscalculated the traffic on the elevators. It's far more than they expected. After a couple of months of opening, there are complaints from everybody. The elevators are too slow. Fix the problem. Now, the first thing you think of is, we'll speed up the elevators. Well, you can't. You can, but it's going to cost a tremendous amount of money. Put another elevator in an established building. That's almost impossible. And Jerry and sorry, I keep doing that. Donald, talk about the different types of solution that have been implemented in the past. First is the building next door hasn't got the same type of people in it. So their elevators are fine. In fact, they have extra capacity, but it's in the building next door. Well, what they suggest is build a bridge from one building to the other. So if you want to go there, you go up first, not down, or you go down. But this will split the traffic on the elevators, go up, cross the bridge, and go down the other way. That's one solution, rather crafty. Here's another one. Put a mirror up by the elevators. People come up to the elevator, they're waiting, so they're going to, you know, adjust their tie and brush their hair, and they don't notice that they've been waiting longer, so the complaints stop. So what's the goal? Is it to make the elevators faster, or is it to stop the complaints? If you have no complaints, you have no problem. I haven't done anything to the elevators. This is the type of thing that we need to understand when we're talking about a problem. It's all about perceptions. In their book, they have this wonderful quote, and it's, problems are differences between desires and expectations. And what I love about the quote is it doesn't mention reality. If you can change someone's perception of how much time they've quote unquote wasted waiting for an elevator, you've stopped the complaints about the elevators being slow. Now, the perfectionists amongst us, those math oriented people, will say, Peter, that's a cop out. The elevator hasn't been changed. It's still operating at the same abysmally slow speed. And the response is, we don't care. Our goal was to have happy customers. And our customers are happy. That's what problem solving is in the real world. It's about understanding that all problems, without exception, are people problems.
Often the engineers and the technical part in our brain wants to tackle the technical side of the problem when maybe we need to back up and redefine, re-examine the problem?
We need to understand how the problem is being articulated. Here's another example. You walk into an office. There is a woman at the office, at the desk. There's a computer on the desk, and you notice the computer is unplugged. The woman says to you, my computer isn't working. What's the problem?
She hasn't noticed that the computer is unplugged.
That is one answer. Here are a couple of things to take into account. First off, you made the assumption it's her computer. She actually works two floors up. She doesn't work at that desk. It's not her computer. Her computer is burning. It's not about the plug. The second thing is, actually, there is no problem for you. You're the pizza guy. You're delivering a pizza. You don't care if her computer is unplugged. Another one, you're the head of janitorial services. What's your problem? Your problem is you're going to have that talk again with the janitor's staff at night who come by and unplug things so they can sweep and then they'll plug it back in. You're the head of corporate training, IT training. Your problem isn't that it's unplugged. Your problem is that your corporate training isn't working, obviously, because she can't figure out computers need to be plugged in. Or perhaps you're a future, very wealthy computer designer who has just figured out that maybe, just maybe, computers need to learn how to plug themselves in. So we have the same situation. And depending upon who looks at the situation, the reality part, that defines what the problem is. It is defined by the person looking at the situation. Notice I said situation, not the problem. No problem exists until someone says, there's a problem over there. And it's a problem because for the following reasons. That's when we have a problem. Until then, there is no problem. I'm doing a webinar, and I've done a webinar by the time people listen to this, and the title of the webinar is There Is No Spoon. And it's from the Matrix movie. And it's the little kid who says, don't try to bend a spoon. That's impossible. Just realize that there is no spoon. And that when it bends, it's because you see it bend. You believe it bends, and then it bends. That's like problem solving. There is no problem until an individual takes a look at the situation and deems there to be a problem.
Peter, does that suggest that we could make more of our problems go away if we just simply looked at them differently or saw them through someone else's eyes?
We could make a lot of problems easier if we took the time to understand what the problem is from the other person's perspective. In other words, why do they believe it's a problem? Do we understand everything about it? And not to get locked into ways of thinking about problems. I was a computer person, and one of the early rules that I learned for myself is never, ever take the user's description of what the problem is at face value. Don't ever do that. Why? Because they're not the computer person. Their perception of the situation differs from yours. Mine is informed by years of experience working with computers and IT. They're just an end user. Their perception is different. It's like the person who takes their car into a garage and say, the engine's making a ticking noise. Fix it. The attendant should just ignore that. It's a clue, but it's not evidence. It's hearsay. It's anecdotal evidence at best. The technician needs to look at the car and figure out what's going wrong. The other thing about problems being defined by people is that if you're working on a team, one of the things you absolutely need to do is agree on not what the solution is going to be, but what is the problem that we're working on. We have to find common ground. The only way we do that is by asking a tremendous number of questions. The problem for the user is not necessarily the problem that you as the technician see. The user might just want the report. They don't care. They don't want the whole report. They just want the bottom line, the single number. They know where it comes from. They don't want the 20-page report summarized and divisioned and categorized and, you know, tabulated and all that. They simply don't want that. But being IT people, we're convinced we know what's best. And we spend an awful lot of time building solutions that nobody ever uses. Every organization has that story. We built a $25 million system. No one uses it. The question comes to mind is, why'd you build it? Why do you spend $25 million on building this thing if none of the users are going to use it? This is what problem solving is all about. Making sure you're working on the right thing. Einstein said, his generalized quote is, you give me 1 hour to solve a problem, I'm going to spend 55 minutes making sure I understand what the problem is. 55 minutes. Most of us, when presented with a problem, we jump right in. That's it. Problem solving hat on and bang, we're in there. We're looking for answers. We're looking for solutions. We don't know what the problem is yet, but that doesn't matter. We want a solution.
Peter, people in trying to be productive or appear productive and proactive and look like they're competent, the reaction is, oh, there's a problem. Let's go fix it. I know the answer. And they believe that that is perceived as being responsive and reactive and just fix it. Make it go away.
There's two things about the language you used. First off, you use the phrase, the answer. There's never one answer. There's never one problem. There are multiple answers. One of the suggestions I have for problem solvers is always come up with two answers to the problem that you're working on. Why two, Peter? Well, so that you can compare the two and choose one, choose the better of the two. If you're looking at the one answer, well, it's one answer. You've got nothing to compare it to. The other one might be better. It might be faster. It might be cheaper. It might be less expensive. You don't know. But you need more answers so that you can choose the right one, so that you can be selective, so that there can be a decision process about what the right answer should be. And a good question for any problem is, what does this solution look like? Right before you start doing anything, even before you've defined the problem, what does it look like? Describe a picture for me of the future where this is no longer a problem for you. That answer is pure gold, because it tells you what might... Give you another example. Years and years and years ago, I'm old, I needed a report printed by noon. And I gave it to one of my employees at 11 o'clock. I said, go get this printed and bring it into the meeting for me. 10 minutes past noon, no report. So I go looking for him. And I find him in front of a printer. And he's got it open and he's fiddling around inside. And I said, what are you doing? He says, this printer is broken and I need to get it fixed so that I can get the report to you. And I suggested, what's the most important thing, getting the printer fixed or getting the report to me? Well, I need to get the printer fixed. I said, there's a printer upstairs. Go use that one. Print the silly report. Get it to me. You've achieved your goal and my goal. And now if you have time to waste, go to the printer that broke down while you were trying to print it in the first place. The broken printer isn't your problem. Your problem was getting the report to me, and you failed miserably because you got locked into, I would have used the solution before. The solution isn't working. I need to fix the solution before I can get you the report.
Now, Peter, I see what one might call linear thinking in his response to your requests. This is the printer that he's always used. Therefore, that's the printer he must use always.
We get locked into, there's a thing in problem solving called mindset, where you get locked into a particular way of using or thinking about something. There was an experiment done where you had to hang a picture up and you had a nail and you had the picture and you had a crucifix. That's it. No hammer. And most people never get the picture hung in the time allotted. And the trick is that they see the crucifix as not being a hammer. You wouldn't hammer a nail with a crucifix. Nails were involved, but not this time. So the solution is pick up the crucifix and bang the nail on the wall. And you've solved it. It's called mindset. There's another word for it called Einstellung. And it relates to the adage, think outside the box, of which there's a huge problem. The problem, look, it's a great phrase. Quite frankly, I think I wish I'd thought of it. Think outside the box. What a great idea. There's one problem with it. If you know what the box is, it's easy to think outside it. But if you don't know what the box is, if you don't know that you're inside a box, everything you do is going to be constrained by you, who you are, what you do, and your experience. An example from my life. Decades ago, I had a blinding headache for about 2 weeks, and it was getting worse. Every single day, it was worse and worse and worse. I go to my doctor. They do some tests, and then they say, well, we need to put you in for a CAT scan because you might have a brain tumor. That would be one answer. So we're going to give you a schedule of a CAT scan. I go to my dentist. I tell you, explain about the headache. He says, oh, I know what the answer is. The answer is you're grinding your teeth at night. So he gets out a grinder, and he starts grinding down my teeth. I was getting desperate, so I went to a chiropractor, different topic. And he says, well, obviously, the third and fourth, the back of your neck needs to be squished and squashed, and he's doing that. Now, it feels great. Massage always feels good for about an hour, and then it stops. Each one of these, the doctor, the chiropractor, and the dentist, are in a box. It's a box of their own making, but that box is invisible to them. The doctor doesn't think of grinding the teeth. The dentist doesn't think of massaging my neck, And the chiropractor doesn't think of a brain tumor because that's not the box they're in. We're all in boxes. Everything we bring to the table brings with it constraints. And it's important to know that, to understand that our perspective is very, very narrow. That's why it's a great idea is quite often to work in teams. Gives you good multiple perspectives on the same problem if you allow people to disagree on what they think the problem is. If you insist that everybody listens to the manager, you're losing the benefit of diversity.
Peter, is problem solving, is it just a matter of fixing things that go wrong?
Well, fixing things, again, says that the problem is in the thing. It's not. It's our perception of what is going on. There are several category types. One is fix the thing that's broken. Look, if I'm trying to get Zoom up and running for this meeting and there's something going on with my computer, I need to fix my computer for this meeting immediately. Or get on another computer. There are several in the house, but that needs to be addressed. I need to fix something. The other thing is the obstacle. Remove the obstacle that's impeding your process. One of the solutions to that is forget about the obstacle. If that person won't say yes, find someone who will. You know, we use the phrase, better to ask forgiveness than beg permission. That's going around the obstacle that we know. So there's fix the thing, go around the thing. But it's never about the thing. It's about how we think about the problem is, what we think it is. And understand, we don't ask enough questions to really understand what is going on when someone brings us a quote-unquote problem.
Peter, when you work with people, you talk to people about problem solving, what do you find often is the first obstacle that they need to overcome?
Their perception of what the problem is. Quite often, if you use these techniques, you'll end up solving the problem. In other words, I go to another printer, I print off the report, and the report gets delivered on time. But the guy who was trying to fix the printer, he says, you didn't fix the problem. The problem was the printer. You cheated. You went around. The guy who puts up the mirror at the elevator, lots of people will say, you didn't fix the problem. You avoided it. And also, there's another thing about problem solving, which most people do not pay attention to. Regardless of what the problem is that you're working on, there are always two problems. It doesn't matter what singular problem you're working on, there's two problems. The one is the one in front of you. And the other one, and this is the mind of the master, how do you avoid that problem in the future? There's always two. How do you fix it now, and how do you stop it from happening again? I can be very, very good at putting out houses that are on fire. But you know what's a better solution? Put in smoke detectors so the house isn't on fire. Avoid them entirely. Best problem solvers in the world never solve problems. They don't have to. They avoided them in the beginning.
And when you say that, I'm guessing that one needs to think more long-term than the immediate, what is perceived as immediate problem, which might need to be addressed, but now I see the strength of there are two problems. How do I put out this fire? How do I prevent future fires?
Yeah. Now, look, we're also very, very busy, right? Especially tech people. We're working night and day. We're very, very, very busy people. And thinking deeper about a problem, yeah, that takes time and we don't want to do it. Fair enough. There's a way around that. I've came up with this for myself years and years and years ago. And that is, problem happens once, fix the problem, move on. Problem happens twice, fix the problem and make a mental note. There may be something going on here. A problem happens three times, stop fixing the problem, find the pattern, and stop it from happening in future. So it's a process. First, fix it. We get it. Next, it's happened again. Okay, I'll fix it again, but I'm taking notes now because I'm wasting my time. And if it happens the third time, that's it. I give up. I'm not going to fix this anymore. I want to find out what's causing it to happen, because that now becomes my problem. The replication, the repetition of the same thing. I want to do it differently. The old adage, right? Insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. Well, if I fix a problem, a problem occurs and I fix it, and a problem occurs and I fix it, a problem occurs and I fix it, I'll be doing that for the rest of my life. Same thing over and over again. Happens once, fix it. Happens twice, take notes and fix it. Three times, there's a pattern here. Find out what the pattern is, the root cause analysis. Fix that, and you won't have to fix this silly problem ever again in your entire life.
Peter, if a big part of solving a problem is based on perspective, then when you bring a team together to work on the problem, each of them brings their own perspective. How do you get them seeing everything from the same view?
Well, again, the way you phrased it, bringing a team on to work on the problem, suggests the problem has already been defined before you bring the team on. A better way to do it is, we have a situation. Let's get a team of people to come in to assess the situation, to figure out what we as a group think the problem is and what we might do about it. In other words, get involvement from everybody who's going to be working on the solution. When Einstein says, out of an hour, I'd spend 55 minutes, the same thing applies for a team. A team should spend the vast majority of their time thinking about what the problem is before they start thinking about how they might solve it. Unfortunately, in corporate life, it doesn't quite work that way. Problems are handed down to the next level in the hierarchy. Fix this. And the people actually putting the solution together aren't involved with defining what the problem is. You know, we're not given that task. We're asked to find a solution, but we're not involved in figuring out what the problem is. That seems counterproductive to me. We're wasting a lot of very, very good talent when we do that. Problem solvers are good people to ask about what is the problem.
And when a problem solver describes or defines a problem, is it okay if they're fuzzy in their description?
It is required that they be fuzzy, that they have some ambiguity, that they're willing to look at alternatives. I'll give you sort of a tangential example. Everybody here has been on a large campus of some type, where there are footpaths all over the place. One of the things we notice, if we pay attention, is that there will be brown, well-worn paths on the grass that take shortcuts. That's called desire pathing. Okay? And basically, it's human nature to cut corners, to follow, and not just cut corners, but you'll see these lines weave and cross. And what they're actually doing is following the terrain. They're like a marble rolling down the path of least resistance. There are pictures on the internet of a lamp post that's leaning over a concrete footpath. And there'll be a worn path around the outside of that leaning pole, because people will not walk under it for whatever reason. Now, here's the thing. You could, if you want, attempt to change human nature and get them to follow the concrete path. And there are ways to do that. You can build fences. You can put a pond between the two. But a better solution is to say, okay, there are some things that are really difficult to change. So let's not change them. Let's just use them. Don't put down the concrete paths until you see where people walk. Then put the paths where people walk. It's a very organic way of doing things. And you could say that it's very ambiguous. Someone says, where are you going to put the paths? I don't know. Where people walk. Where are they going to walk? I don't know. Let's watch them. Oh, they walk there. Put the path there. It works. If you want to see an expert at this, look at Disney. There are no worn paths on the grass anywhere in Disney World. Why? Because they found out what the desire paths are, and that's where they built the paths. And it feels comfortable. It's natural. It's where you would normally walk. Why go against human nature?
Now, I'm inclined to think that going against human nature is not the way to solve problems. It sounds like how can we leverage human nature to...
How can you exploit it, leverage it, take it into account? There's another example on the internet. On a beach, there is a first aid kit or something in a red container. And there's a big sign on the thing. It says, don't throw your litter in here. This is a first aid kit. And everybody's throwing their litter in there. What's the problem? Well, people can say, well, you know, they should be hauling their litter out themselves. People are lazy. Well, no, not really. They're not really lazy. They actually walked up to that thing that looked like a litter bin and put their litter there. They're not littering. They're putting it where they think. So what's the problem? Well, what's the solution? Well, obviously people have litter. So put a litter bin next to it. Or another thing, don't make the receptacle look like a red litter bin. Make it look like something else. If you don't want people to see it as a litter bin, don't make it look like a litter bin.
Now,
human nature will fill it up.
Curious, Peter, that you say that. It was recently that I had a hamburger at a fast food place, and naturally, and I was eating it outside the restaurant because of the pandemic. And when I finished, I looked for a container, a bin to throw my paper in, and I found one there. I threw it in there, and as I walked away, I looked back, and then I realized that was actually a planter, but there was no plant in it. But that's where I put my garbage, and I didn't bother taking it out because I wasn't going to put the garbage on the floor, on the sidewalk.
Another thing that Disney does is that there is set distance. Say you go to a hot dog stand. You don't have litter right by the hot dog stand, because you're still eating your hot dog. So how long does it take someone to eat a hot dog? How far do they walk? Well, you figure that out. And how do you do that? By watching. And when they finish their hot dog, it's about 40 or 50 feet. That's where you put a litter bin, because they're going to need to throw litter away about 40 or 50, whatever the number is. That could be off. But that's how Disney is designed. Disney is designed to play to human nature. If you've been to Disney, you'll notice that you don't notice. The lines are incredibly long, hundreds of people. So what do? If they had a long straight line, people would complain, like the elevator, right? The lines are too long, make them move faster. What Disney does is they snake them around. And at each part in the curvy path of where people are lined up, there's something to look at. And you never see how long the line is. And you're preoccupied by looking at other things. So they don't increase the speed of the line. What they increase is your tolerance for it taking so long. And they do that by adding entertainment along the path. Same idea as putting up the mirror by the elevator.
Powerful lesson there for anywhere that people complain about how long it takes. Maybe we just need to find a way to entertain them to make it seem more bearable.
Either entertain them or consume their time in another way. At the elevators, what if you had a coffee machine? A little coffee stand by the elevators. What would you do? You'd come up. If the elevator's there, you're going to take the elevator. If it's not there, you're going to pour yourself a cup of coffee. And that takes a couple of minutes, which reduces your waiting time, because you're not waiting when you're pouring coffee. You're pouring coffee. So by the time you finish pouring your coffee and putting your milk and cream in, the elevator has come, so you go in. Again, you've slowed down you've increased your tolerance for the amount of time spent in front of an elevator by consuming some of that time by some other activity. This is problem solving, where you really have to understand what is going on. If you give the slow elevator problem, the complaint file, to a elevator engineer, their recommendation will be, we need to increase the motors, the stepping motors at the top of the building, so it can move a little bit faster, and we'll reduce the time that it takes for a door to close, and we'll speed up the doors, we'll do everything. All of that, understand, might solve the problem at great expense. Putting up a mirror is cheaper and just as effective.
And it could even be fun if they use those mirrors, you know, that they use in the fun house, the curved ones, the convex, and then people stand there looking in the mirrors and saying, whoa, look at me.
Absolutely. Or you put up a mirror that you put up two mirrors, and one isn't a reflection of you, it's the other guy. It's like a screen. There are actually mirrors like that in the world, large exhibits in a town square or something, where you have one in, say, Birmingham, and then you have another one in Tokyo. So the people in Birmingham are looking at the people in Tokyo and waving their hands and everything. The people can see them and are waving back. It's a great attraction, great way to bring two cities and two peoples together. And they even have voices in some of them.
Mm. Peter, for those who might want to know more about the skills you provide and the programs you have, I know you have an extensive library online of webinars that people can access. Where can they find that?
Okay, first off, the archive of webinars. First off, there's more than 100 webinars on everything from problem solving, creativity, stress release, project management, you name it. And you can find that at www.technobility.online. Now, technobility, where does that come from? I was sitting in a cubicle one day, IT guy on the other side of the cubicle, berating an end user, saying, you're a techno peasant, which I found rude and crude and totally unnecessary. And my immediate thought was, we are not techno peasants. We are tech nobility. We're the ones who make computers do what we want them to make. So that's where the name comes from. It'll also help you how to spell it. Tech nobility, TechNobility. And contacting me is pdiager, pdiager, at technobility.com. You can email me there. If you email me and say, Peter, put me on your mailing list, we'll put you on a mailing list. We'll give you updates every month on our next webinar. The next one is called Problem Solving, There Is No Spoon. Or rather, it'll be the last one because this will come later. So those are the two ways you can contact me.
Peter, if you could sit down with a manager who's you know, returning to work or has returned to work dealing with people, and if you could give them one, two, or maybe three pieces of advice to address problems that they might be encountering in the new workplace, what might be those one, two, or three pieces of advice that could help them, maybe save them some stress?
The first is, everybody has a different perspective on what COVID did to them and what returning to the office might feel like. And those concerns are valid. For more than a year, some people have worked at home. One of the biggest benefits is they didn't have to commute. That's an extra hour and a half, 2 hours of their day that they had to do something else with. If you're having them come back to the office, it's not just about coming back to the office. It's about they're losing another 2 hours of their day every day, which they might resist. So understand their different perspectives. Understand what those perspectives might be by asking. And then the other one would be, figure out from them, what were the benefits of COVID? Now, obviously, we're not talking about the deaths and the illness and the chaos, but there were benefits. There were things that worked to our advantage. A lot of people, quite frankly, like working outside the office. In North America, there's a huge, quote unquote, labor shortage of people simply not wanting to come back to the office. And if they are forced back, you might lose some very, very good people. In fact, you'll always lose very, very good people. You'll lose your best because your best will be able to find work similar to the lockdown situation. So understand that not everybody has the same perspective. Understand that there were some benefits. And understand that if you want this to succeed, there has to be a blend between what works for the organization and what works for the individuals. Because the individuals have discovered something. They have more freedom than they ever thought they had. Working from home is a blessing for most people. You spend a lot more time with your family. And for some people, that's an issue. But for most people, it's a good thing.
My guest today is Peter DeJager, reminding you that we all are in boxes. We just might not be aware of what box we're in.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.